I'm Brian Kiley.
I'm Juju Sanders.
And this is Engaging Culture, the podcast presented by Bridgeway Christian Church. On this episode, we're going to look at habits. What are they? Why are they so powerful? How can we change them for the better? We'll talk a little bit about the tragedy in New Orleans and about what that can teach us about the importance of community and just staying healthy in a bunch of different ways. And with the recent passing of the 39th President of the United States, Jimmy Carter, we will reflect a bit on his faith, his life, and his legacy. We'll have a little fun along the way, all of that and more on this episode of Engaging Culture. Pastor Judah, here we are. It is 2025.
You know, you said we were going to talk about Jimmy Carter, and it really has made me want Jimmy John's. So,
well, I guess
let's barrel through this. I'm hungry.
Let's get through this so you can get your
Happy New Year,
your Jimmy John's. And yes, Happy New Year to you. Now, Pastor Judah, you and I talked at the end of this last year, and we were thinking, you know, what this show needs is another co-host. We needed a third voice, a competent, witty, clever, intelligent third voice.
Yeah, yeah,
to come
somebody
and join
we enjoy talking to.
The show. And we searched far and wide.
I mean, high and low.
For somebody.
From the north to the south.
Who could fit that description.
From the east to the west.
Fielding applications, turning down.
From the rising of the sun till the setting of the same.
Those who wanted to take this esteemed third seat onto the, up to this point, two-person podcast.
We required a 200-signature petition.
And dear listeners, after all of that failed.
Thank you, Jesus. Won't he provide?
We asked the one and only
one
Josh
down.
Ute if he would come and participate in the Engaging Culture podcast. Pastor Josh Ute.
Pastor.
Welcome.
Bishop. Apostle.
To
chief
the
prolate.
18th most important thing in your life.
Yes, the high
Engaging
priest.
Engaging Culture podcast co-host seat. I can only
Teacher,
imagine.
Teacher, scholar, prophet.
I can only imagine how honored you must feel
the
right
psalmist.
Now.
The psalmist. Teacher of teachers.
I feel like I'm being introduced at the Nathan's Hot Dog contest. We're just getting way too much promise. For a very
I never get
delivery.
To do this to anybody because Brian always does this kind of foolishness to me. So I'm
yeah, that was pretty fun. And in case this wasn't obvious, I was making that up as I went. Even
you know,
when I hit record, I didn't really know what I was going to say.
It was fantastic. I was insulted and encouraged all in the exact same time.
That Mission was the goal. So, well, Josh, we are excited to have you with us. And for you listeners, our hope is that kind of just getting some additional perspectives in here will make the podcast a little more fun, a little more interesting, a few more different views represented, and hopefully just make for a show that is worth the time you spend listening to it. So, best thing you saw this week, Pastor Judah, go.
Best thing I saw this week was literally today in staff meeting at Bridgeway. One of our pastors, Pastor Heather, was teaching about discouragement. And she just really, really blessed me because she has a way of taking things that are hard to hear and hard to do and making them digestible. And so I love that she just really encouraged us to ask each other, what are the ways that we can be helpful when we're feeling discouraged. And I just thought, you know, you should really do that with everyone in your life.
Totally.
And so it was just the best thing.
It was, yeah, she did amazing. I'm with you. It was phenomenal. Josh, how about you?
Best thing, my daughter has developed some really great relationships in her life. And so she's had sleepovers and like her social calendar is so much fuller than mine.
Well, we like her more.
Well, she's more likable.
Yeah, true story.
But seeing your kids thrive relationally is one of the greatest joys.
Oh,
and so that is easily one of the top things I've seen this week.
That's
awesome.
That
is dope.
Love to see that. Love to see that. For me, it was a great last week. Was able to take a few days off, went to a play with my wife, watched some sports at home with the kids, just had a fun, you know, couple of days. But we started our basketball season on Saturday. I'm coaching two teams, both of my sons on different teams. And
Lord bless you.
Both of them had just kind of wild games on Saturday that were intense. Oftentimes when you hear intense, that's negative, but it was not negative. It was just really hard fought, tough, good basketball. And I was exhausted by the end of it. I'm like, okay, now I got to have lunch and go to work. But seeing my boys hoop and just getting to be a part of that, and we love our rec league in Lincoln is phenomenal. The guy who runs it is phenomenal, and it was great. So it's coaching two teams is a lot of work. It takes up a lot of time,
Sounds
but
like
it
a
is a labor of love, and we're loving it.
are your boys still talking to you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Well, so, that's amazing because I've coached my son, and we realized very quickly I cannot coach him. I can coach my daughter all day, but my son's like, nope.
Well, and one of my kids, it's like you and your daughter. We have a great relationship on the court. The other, I have not coached nearly as much. And I'll be honest, there was a little part of me that was like, well, let's see how this goes. Now, we had some assistant coaches, both of whom he knows really well. So I'm like, all right, push comes to shove. We split into different groups. But he's been great. He's done a good job, and we're having fun so far. We'll be right back.
It is 2025, and you, dear listener, like all of us, are probably thinking about how you're going to make your 2025 better. And so we have been reading and researching about habits lately. What are some things that you guys have found interesting as you've been just learning about habits?
I find habit and habit formation and all of that to be really fascinating, both on the level of like, I mean, how often is it like, for me, for example, if I'm going to drive home 99% of the time from, like, say, here, it's to my house. But maybe on a Saturday evening after church, I might go to my parents' house, and it's one exit down the freeway. Like, how often I'll still get off at my exit, like, right, not thinking about what I'm doing. Mm. And we've all had those experiences, right, where you just, like, automate behavior and you're just lost in not doing what you wanted to do because you're so used to, you know, the force of habit. One thing I found interesting was from a psychologist of habitual behavior named Benjamin Gardner. He said, people who are best at achieving their goals are the ones who purposefully form habits to automate some of the things that they do. So even that automation element that if I want to be successful at achieving whatever my goal might be, I need to find a way to automate some of the steps to get me to that goal. When for me, too often, I think a lot of what is automated is maybe like not great habits. Like, I'm walking the 50 yards from my office to the printer, I just sort of instinctively pull out my phone. Like stuff like to do nothing, by the way, nothing productive. So I think that element, but I'm very fascinated by trying to look at how can I kind of put automation to work for me in a way that is helping me as opposed to hindering me from things that matter.
Totally. One of the things that I was thinking through is like, so William James observed, this is a guy from the 1890s, and he said that we're nothing if not bundles of habits.
Yeah.
That so often I think of habits as task-oriented versus literally everything that I do in life is built on some sort of habit. There is a habitual nature of all of that. Wake up, get dressed, have breakfast, go to work. Yes, these are routines. We call them routines, but really they're habits. These are things that we've created in ourselves. And so it changes the frame of reference for me a little bit about bad habits and good habits. It's everything's a habit. And so how do we automate, to what you said, the good things so that they become a natural part of our lives? Because I look at really successful people, whether that's successful in their health, successful financially, successful in their marriages and families and all that. They do things consistently and regularly as a part. It looks like, well, that's just their personality. That's what it looks like to us. But really, it's the forms of habits. These habits have led to these outcomes.
Yeah.
And my habits have led to my outcomes. Oh my gosh. Jim Collins, thank you.
There we go.
Wrote a book.
You're welcome.
Who are you thanking?
I think you just thanked yourself. Anyway, go on.
Look at you being gracious and compassionate to yourself.
Left brain thanking right brain. Yes. Jim Collins said every organization is perfectly designed to get the results that they're getting, good and bad.
Yep.
And this is the same thing for us. Our habits are perfectly designed to be giving us the results that we're getting.
Yep.
And so that's a really good challenge, and it's convicting and stupid. but it's an opportunity for us to say, okay, if I can develop the habits to meet the goals that I want to see in my life, I'm going to see these results at some point.
Yeah. Pastor Judah, I know you saw some stuff that was interesting and irritating, to put it mildly.
Let me start off being my most professional self. The biggest thing that I learned was that I had never thought about habits being more powerful than decisions, right?
Mm, yeah,
and good. Then intentions, right? And so this idea that our habits do not keep up with our intentions, right?
Yeah.
Our habits are the things that we repeat over and over again, and how just powerful that is. And there was a study done in 2011, that was kind of examining the relationship between emotional eating and habits. And essentially, what this brilliant researcher, who nobody asked for this research, thank you kindly, decided to put out into the world in a spirit of wickedness, is that emotional eating or emotional eaters, emotional eating is more about habits than actually like the emotion of the day, right? So the theory is that we eat because we had a really bad day or a big fight with our spouse or whatever. But when they researched it, what they found was that like the people ate basically the same way, regardless of what their emotions are. And so it was just like getting the crutch kicked out from underneath me, because I was very content and happy to say, well, you know, I'm an emotional eater, and so that's why I... And it's like, no, Judah, you just like to get up at 10:30 p.m. and go rummage in the refrigerator. That's what your problem is.
Well, and that's such a tricky thing, because I think that in some ways it does sort of kick the crutch out from under us, and it's kind of invalidates a lot of the excuses we make. Oh, well, I'm just this way because of this. Totally. And I think that in the vast majority of cases, yeah, we're just lying to ourselves and making excuses for our own unhealthy behaviors. Now, I think in some cases, yeah, there is legitimate trauma. There is legitimate stuff that is behind. And that obviously requires a deeper level of care to kind of heal from. So I want to make sure anybody who's sort of in that boat is able to differentiate here. But
ask for me in my house.
But I think, but seriously though, like how often is it that we fail to establish new habits because instead of making new habits, we want to make excuses for ourselves? Like I, for the last like year or two, have developed the discipline of never giving an excuse for why I'm late. Or if I do, it comes later. Like I'm late and I'm sorry. Because so often it's, well, I'm late because of X, Y, and Z. And X, Y, and Z might be legit. But what I want to communicate to the person is, we agreed on this. I failed to meet our agreement. I am sorry. And what I want to communicate to myself is, Brian, it is your responsibility to be on time regardless of X, Y, and Z. Now, am I perfectly on time all the time? I am not. But I think that too often, my point is, I think for a lot of years, I reinforced bad behavior by, oh, well, I'm late because of this, because of that, because of the other thing. Instead of, no, Brian, you're just not making it a priority to be on time. And I think that level of honesty, sort of as you were humorously making that point, Pastor Judah, is frustrating and convicting, but it's necessary if we're going to be healthy.
I agree. And I think the research was interesting, and there's probably some truth to it. Research is research, so that means that it's, you know, it's not fact, it's what people are learning. I think the bigger thing that it tells us is that habits tell the truth.
Yeah.
Right? Your habits really do. And I think that where I get myself in trouble is that I think that my intentions are more true than my habits.
Mm.
And so I'm very challenged by all of this that I'm learning about habits.
That's really good.
Because the truth that it tells does not feel good, is not always consistent with my idealized self, with the way I think about myself, with the way I want to be thought about. And what I've thought a lot about is how the truth that habits tell often are the experiences that people have with me.
Hmm.
And so where there's a disconnect in those things, we've all had the experience where somebody said, this was my experience with you. And you're like, absolutely not. I'm not this way. I'm not. And now what I'm thinking about is that when that happens, it is a red light to tell me, hey, check the habits around that thing to see what's actually true.
Yeah, that's good.
That's really good. That's actually convicting and distracted me. Thanks.
This research.
To your point, our habits reveal what we care about.
Yeah.
Our habits are more of a report card than they are a conscious decision of what's going on, because we're seeing the things that we're doing and how they integrate and how do they lead to either the predicament or the success that we are finding ourselves.
Yeah. And what one interesting element of habit that's really important, which, by the way, Charles Duhigg's book, The Power of Habit, Why We Do What We Do in Life and Business, is highly recommended. It's a fascinating exploration of the topic. But he and others have made the point that when it comes to habit change, that especially when it comes to things like breaking bad habits, it is simply not enough to say,
correct,
I am going to stop doing X, because that creates a void, and that void is going to be filled with something. Now, I'm going to backtrack a little bit and say, I think I was talking about automation earlier. There are things we could do to increase the likelihood that something is automated. After a very high bill at the dentist's office, I decided, flossing, we got to figure this out. So my flossers are in my direct line of sight.
Correct.
So I have more or less automated, and I'm very consistent, partially motivated by a huge dental bill. And that's more or less automated. I floss regularly now, I'm happy to say, finally. But when it comes to other habits, say somebody who wants to drink less, or somebody who wants to eat less junk food, or somebody who wants to kind of eliminate something, we have to be able to give some thought to, what reward am I getting from the bad habit?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
And then how can I have a different sort of cue to get to that reward, or adjust that reward in a way that's realistic.
Because I'm just trying to figure out, how in the world do I make celery give me the reward that donuts do?
I literally had celery for lunch today.
Look at you.
I know. We're all depressed.
Well, yeah, I'm really sad just thinking about that, and I don't even eat meat, so you're making me sad. But I think even, Judah, in that sort of, I know it's a tongue-in-cheek example, but I also think
that's
part of the problem with habit change, is we go, I'm going to replace my donuts with celery. Mm. Nobody eats celery, and it's like, man, this is delicious. This does the same thing for me as a donut, that I think on some level, this is New Year's time, New Year's resolutions, a huge reason.
No, Pastor, you eat gross stuff all the time, and you seem happy.
Well, here's the...
seems thin.
You're not wrong. But my point is, I think we're in, you know, New Year's resolution time.
Yeah.
So often, New Year's resolutions fail because they're too ambitious.
That's good.
That I think if you're looking at replacing, and again, nobody, I don't think, is in their right mind going, I'm going to replace donuts with celery.
What did you have for breakfast this morning?
A smoothie that was full of sticks and mud, as you would say. But my point is, I think to go, let's go, all right, we're going to work instead of the donut, we're going to go for the bagel, right? All right, now we're kind of comfortable with the bagel. Bagel's not super healthy either. Eventually, I'm going to move from bagel
worse.
To something.
Yeah,
I actually read about
this. It's just funny to me.
Hey, I'm not a bagel eater because I know they're
glucose.
Because I know they're bad. I know they're bad for you. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's a bad example. But I guess my point is to be able to kind of change our habits in progressive ways that are realistic.
I hear you. Yeah, I think one of the things that is really important for us is that we have to have a really clear why we do what we do.
Yeah.
And if your why is comfort, you will never change your habits.
Ooh, that's good.
Because your comfort is your homeostasis. That's your place that you always go back to. That is what you do now.
Yeah.
But in order to make that change, you have to get uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And you have to make uncomfortable decisions that lead to uncomfortable habits that become natural. And then you change your comfort zone. Yeah. And what's really important is when we have a really clear why, then we have some things that we can do to remedy the fallout. Because for you, you said that it's too aspirational, or like it's too high of a bar. Mm-hmm. I think there's part of that. I also think it's really based on how we think and talk about it. Oftentimes when people take on a new diet, they tell you all the stuff they can't eat, they no longer can do, how hard it is, or, you know, it's a struggle right now, but I'm going to feel better eventually, you know, type of thing. But they're talking about it in the negative versus... I want to be healthier so I can be more active with my kids.
Yeah.
And by dropping weight, I'm actually able to play with my kids more.
Yeah.
I'm able to be more present. When I don't eat as much sugar, I'm able to focus more. You know,
that sense of vision.
Yeah. And then as opposed to talking about what you don't do, it's like, this is what I am doing. And this is why I like what I'm doing.
Yeah.
As opposed to, this food sucks, but, you know, hopefully I look good. Yeah. Like that'll never work. But when you do the, I want to eat this food. I want to have celery. I had other things as well. but I want to have this celery because this is going to lead to the results that I want.
Yeah.
As opposed to, I have to eat this celery. That's a completely different thing.
Yeah.
And that positive thing is not just like that Pollyanna, like super new agey thing that, you know, Oprah made really famous decades ago of like, oh, just send your positivity into the universe. Like, yeah. No, it's not that, but it is just intentionally saying, I'm not going to focus on the negative. I'm going to focus on the vision and the positive that's ahead of me.
I also think that you have to build the smaller habits around the bigger habit that you're trying to change. So when if we take this, you know, this what I eat thing, it's like, yeah, I don't want to eat donuts, but also maybe that means I need to drive a different way to church, which is not the, you know, the
right by the donut
the
shop.
The rote way that I drive to church that's right by the donut. Like, that's a small thing, but it's like, change that habit. Focus also on the things around instead of just the don't eat donut.
Yeah.
How do I set myself up in my habits to not be in a position where I'm likely to struggle when it gets harder, likely to let go of my goal.
That's huge. I think that, and I think that on some level, to go, okay, what are the sort of precursors to the habitual behavior I don't like? I want to comment on something you just said, Josh, because I think it's so important. Just that idea of kind of that sense of the why. Mm-hmm. Like, I even look at in my own life, I love the New York Times, like, word games and all of that, connections and sports connections and Wordle and, you know, the whole thing. I play several of them. Nerd, yeah, right. And I caught myself that so often that was the first thing I would do in the morning is I would grab my phone and I'd play the word games. Do I think that's necessarily wrong? No. But I know this. I do not want to be the sort of person whose first thing they do every morning is play a dumb game on my phone. I just don't want to be that sort of
person.
Be
like me.
I became that. I became that sort. I was becoming that sort of person. And there's no judgment on anybody else. If that is, like, seriously, like, no judgment. But for me, I was like, I just don't want that. Yeah. So I had to build the habit of, like, okay, I'm not going to play these silly New York Times word games until at least I've had some sort of spiritual input for the day, whether that's listening to the Bible or Lectio 365 in the car on the way in, whether that's having a quiet time at home, whatever. And it's almost like now it's funny, I'll reach for my phone to turn off my alarm and it's like, I'll start to swipe to go. And I'm like, wait, nope, this is not what we do. Just because I'm a big believer in, like, starting your day with something meaningful, as meaningful as Wordle is.
Yeah. There's a phrase in counseling and coaching circles that is, people don't do what they should do. They do what they want to do.
Yep.
And sometimes we want to avoid consequence. So we go to a job that we don't like because we need the income.
Yeah.
And so because I don't want to be homeless, I'm going to go ahead and keep going to this job. You know, like,
which can be pretty motivating,
which is pretty motivating, but like, that's why they want to do it. So even stuff they don't like, that's their why is better.
Yeah.
And so it's the same thing with our health. It's the same thing with, you know, getting into our Bible reading. And it's like, if you read your Bible just because I should read my Bible more, it'll be fruitless exercise anyway.
Yep.
And so then you're just spinning your wheels, and that's no longer helpful.
Yeah.
And so it's not leading to the results. Whereas if you focus on the results, then all these other things are going to start to come through, because when we get locked into these things that we're just like, I should do this, I should do this, I should eat this way, I should exercise this much, it won't last.
Yeah.
Because it's not ultimately focusing in on where we need to go.
Yeah. So as you're considering this new year and things you want to do, we just want to encourage you, as you're prayerfully thinking about your habits and your lifestyles and the things that you're doing, think about that vision for your life, that why are you doing things? I don't know that any of us have shoulded ourselves into a better kind of consistent way of living, but when we can get sort of when we can get a sense of sort of God's vision and a greater vision for our lives, that's what makes change.
We having celery O's for breakfast.
So I don't know about that. We'll be right back. By now, certainly all of you have heard about the tragic attack in New Orleans in the early hours of the new year, when Shamsud Bahar Jabbar drove a truck down Bourbon Street, killing and wounding many people. One of our nation's worst terror attacks in recent memory. And certainly there's no shortage of information, both news and opinion, about the details of this event. But what we wanted to talk about is, just, we look at this man's life And in many regards, it was fairly ordinary. He had served in the military. He had recently held a six-figure job in working in kind of information technology. He had converted to Islam. When he went to go commit this attack, he left an out-of-office message that certainly sounded like somebody who was coming back, right? Who was just going to be out of office for a few days. And yet, as more details have emerged about him, we see a pattern of withdrawal from society, increasing kind of radicalization in terms of being online and being exposed to ISIS-related and other kind of radical ideology that then led, really tragically, to the horrific events of January 1st on Bourbon Street. So this can feel like really big and really kind of this thing that was way out in the world and didn't have anything to do with us, and certainly his actions are extreme to a level that hopefully none of us would ever consider.
Yeah, that's right.
But ultimately, Pastor Judah, what's important for us to do in a situation like this is to go, okay, what can we learn from kind of not the event itself, but everything we know about what led Jabbar down this path?
Yeah, there's something interesting about this combination that he seems to have of these really high moral values in the SoundCloud voice notes that they found from him. I mean, he's talking about the importance of marriage and what that should look like. He's talking, you know, kind of espousing these family values, these very traditional, more conservative ideas. And what happens when those ideas become almost idols in our lives? And then what happens when that is mixed with like a lot of pain? And I was even thinking just now that the mixture of failing to uphold those ideas, I mean, when we were reading about him, one of the things you brought up, Pastor Brian, was that he's divorced three times, right?
As somebody who espouses an incredibly high view of marriage.
Correct, yeah. Right. Like there's this, that mixture is actually super dangerous, right? Mm. And so, you know, what I'm thinking about is, okay, what ideas do I hold on to the tightest? Mm. How do I make sure that those ideas are the ideas of the character that I want to espouse and that I want my family to espouse, but not something that I'm trying to control the world with? Because he believed that, you know, music was evil, intoxicants was evil, pleasure was evil, and that's in part what we think led him to commit this heinous act. So how can I make sure that my high, lofty ideas that I think are better than everybody else's ideas and my views of morality don't become idols? And then how do I deal with my own shortcomings, my own failures, and my own very real pain? Because what we see is that this, you can go from somebody who's literally serving in the military, like defending the country with your life. That's a big deal. That's a big sacrifice, right? And to go from that to taking the lives of your fellow citizens on purpose, while that seems like a large leap, I'm not sure that it is. Josh, what are you noticing from this guy?
So I think that's the exact question that we can be asking. Because when we talk about the idea of radicalization, we often associate it with Islamic radicalization, and for good reason. But there's also, to differing degrees, radicalization within the Christian faith as well, of being so tied in. So I think back into the 80s and 90s of bombings of abortion clinics and how that became a big thing, because we had this strong stance of like, we know we're right, we're going to do this, and in order to stop these things, we're going to carry out violence. Like, so this is not unique to different areas. And so I think back, and I think part of what it is that we should be really mindful of in all of our spaces and all of our mindsets is this idea that being right is not more important than being loving.
That's good.
And we have to balance that. When so they will know that you're my followers because of how you love one another.
Yeah.
Not because you're right.
Yeah.
I believe it's Proverbs warns us that knowledge puffs up.
Yeah.
It's this idea that being right is not the biggest thing for a bunch of reasons. And I can go way too many rabbit trails on that. But But this idea that I'm so morally right, I'm so morally superior, everybody else has to do, they have to live like that. That might actually even be somewhat true to a certain extent of like, yes, society would be better if we all held to this, to these moral codes that the Lord has provided. However, when it moves from, I'm going to love you and I'm going to care for you and I'm going to be an example to you of how to rightly live, and it moves into, I'm going to control you and condemn you, then we're into a lot of trouble.
Well, and it's almost, I mean, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but kind of what you're saying is we need to be really careful to not let the fact that we believe that we are right become an excuse to become unloving.
Correct. Well, and it's I mean, biblically, that idea caused the Pharisees to miss Jesus, right?
Yes.
So the consequences of that, while for most of us in Jesus' name will never be as extreme as this fella, there are real consequences to that idolatrous relationship with being right. And then how do we mitigate, like, that we have the idea of a thing, but I don't know about y'all, but like, I fail and miss that standard all the time.
Yeah.
So what are you guys thinking about in terms of how you process when you look at the life that you espouse to live and you realize you've fallen short of that?
Yeah. I think number one, you have to be willing to do that, because I think so often we're so afraid to do that, that we project our failures to live up to our own standards onto others.
Yeah.
When an appropriate reaction to that is confession and repentance, both to God and others, and not this, I'm responding to my own insecurity with now this hyper judgment.
Yeah, I think the word is grace.
Yeah,
that's good.
We need grace for ourselves. Yeah, oftentimes, the people who exhibit the least amount of grace to others exhibit the least amount of grace to themselves.
100%.
And so they are holding themselves and condemning themselves to a point where they really can't even engage in the world anymore or even into self-reflection in a way that's healthy. One of the things that I love to harp on with folks is that Jesus says, I did not come to condemn the world, but to save it.
Yeah.
If Jesus didn't come to condemn it, then neither should we.
Somebody's reading their Bible.
So,
somebody's reading.
And if our theology and our faith leads us to more condemnation than a conversation, then we're in a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
And that conversation is where that redemptive pieces can really take place. And so while I might feel like I'm right, and, you know, Brian's wrong about something.
As he usually
is. No, I'm not.
Never. He usually is. Yeah, never. But the way that we get to a redemptive process is actually through conversation, not me saying, Brian, you're wrong, and then walking out of the room and just moving on.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing with ourselves. It's just like, Josh, you suck, is not nearly as helpful as, Josh, you're struggling with this, but here's a way forward.
Yeah.
I just think that means that there has to be present a way forward, right? That people need to know that there's a way forward, right? And have hope in it. And I think that that's one of the distinctives of Christianity, right? Is that ours is the faith that says there is a way forward, even in all your struggle and dropping the ball and the righteous man falls 7 times, that there's this Jesus who died and paid for it so that you can fall and get up and fall and get up and maybe not fall as much as you journey. Yeah.
2 Corinthians 12:9-10 says, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Damn. Therefore, I will boast all the more gladly in my weaknesses than so that the power of Christ may rest upon me. For the sake of Christ, then, I am content with my weaknesses, insults, hardships, persecutions, and calamities. For when I am weak, then I am strong. This idea that we can be content in our weaknesses from Paul is very weird, and it's very anti-world view. But it's like, okay, I am not perfect. I am not my own Messiah.
Yeah.
I am going to mess up. I will not ever achieve this perfection, but Christ is perfect. Therefore, I don't need to be perfect, but I can always move forward with the hope that there's transformation possible because of him.
And I think just to really make sure we're being super clear about how this relates to the original story here is that seeming lack of grace for himself seemed to be a driving factor in the intensity of his judgment toward others.
That's
and I just think what does this mean for us? I think it's generally a healthy practice that when we see these extreme things in society, that we just kind of go, okay, like, we're not going to go to this level, but like, what small part of that exists in me where now I'm actually being extremely judgmental to the people in my community group and the way that they parent their kids, for example. And really, I like to think it's because they're not doing it right.
I think they're shocked to hear you say that right now.
So this is metaphorically speaking, of course. we are the worst parents in our community group. But to go, oh, well, I feel the need to be very critical and judgmental of them because I think they're not doing it right. When the truth is, the reason I feel that way is actually I'm extremely insecure in my own parenting, and I'm now projecting that into criticism.
I just want to say, if you really are the worst parents in your parent group, then you're that group, those kids are going to be the next president.
They're doing all right.
And congressmen and lawyers.
So another element of this I want to talk about is the social withdrawal and online radicalization component. Mm. This is an individual who clearly dealt with a lot of rejection in his life. And we don't really know to what extent that was his fault, someone else's fault, just kind of it is what it is. We don't know. And that's not what we're here to make a judgment on. But we know this, that it led him to disengage from people. His neighbors say he wasn't really around much. His behavior was becoming so erratic that his ex-wife and her current husband wouldn't allow him around their daughters. Yeah. And he clearly had been radicalized online. Once again, to my original point, this is an extreme example. I think we need to take a look at where does this exist in a much smaller way in all of us? And here is kind of the idea I want to throw out here for us is I think that all of us are desperate for acceptance from other people, but we are more sensitive to rejection than perhaps ever. So what happens is we are more likely to not do the work of forming relationships, and that equals more time online, more time doom scrolling, more time listening to more radical voices that are selling fear and partisanship and everything else. And now for every one person that we've got radicalized who commits a terrible crime, I mean, we've got 1,000 people who are believing just objectively false things, and especially in the political space where just supporting your side seems to value more than telling the truth about simple facts.
Right.
So that's where I think we have to be really careful as Christians to go, no, I'm actually not going to withdraw. That God calls us into community. I want to press into community. And just, I'm always harping on this. We just have to be so careful about the level of influence that comes from online versus the level of influence that comes in person.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing to me is when we isolate, we are only left with our voice.
Yeah, that's right.
That's good.
And for some folks who are ultra positive, that even turns negative on them.
Yeah.
Like, just because they have a positive exterior doesn't mean they have a positive interior.
Yeah.
And so it's always very surprising for that. And so having other people is crucial. The other thing that I was just thinking about as you're talking about that is in my own personal life, I have noticed that when I have strong relationships, even if it's just two or three, if I have strong relationships, the other rejection pieces are easier to take because I know I already have people that are with me.
Yeah, that's good.
And so while those are difficult and then nobody likes that, like nobody I can't wait to be rejected today. I mean, feels like high school all over again. I just can't wait for that to happen. Like, nobody wakes up thinking that way. But when you have a really strong core, even if it's just two or three other people, it gives you the stability relationally with the world around you to endure.
Yeah.
To endure those.
Gives us kind of a sense of resilience, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
And that's why I think it's, you know, here we place such an emphasis on community. And and really the centerpiece of Christianity is community with Jesus.
Totally.
And, you know, I'm just thinking about how, God's self.
Yeah.
Is community, Father, Son, and Spirit in this mutual loving relationship, right? And in order to experience God, you need the community of God, right?
Yeah.
And so I think we need to be thinking about this year, as extreme as this circumstance is and as distant as it feels, that things like building community and making that the centerpiece of your religious practice, right? Yeah. Like, if you are more concerned about, you know, memorizing a commandment than you are with having relationship with the other people who also are subscribed to that commandment,
where you can live out that commandment.
Correct. you're going to miss it, and at its worst, it culminates in circumstances like this.
Yep.
And I kind of want to end with this thought, and this is out of 1 Peter 5:9, and this goes to the value of community in just this second part, is knowing that the same kinds of suffering are being experienced by your brotherhood throughout the world.
Yeah.
This idea that you are not alone. Jabbar's story is not unique in the sense of nobody's experienced 3 divorces before. What could he possibly be going through? Nobody's experienced losing you're cool. Nobody's experienced not having access to your kids. Like, he is not alone.
Yep.
This is not a unique story. But oftentimes in our distress and in our isolation, we believe that nobody understands us. Nobody can possibly get what we're going through. But it's in community, in relationship, that we see that our brothers and sisters have experienced the same thing. Yep. And we can walk together through this.
Yep. Oh, you too. Yeah. Right. Amen. So it's an extreme event. Lots for us to look at in terms of, hey, to what extent do these things live in us to a small degree, and inspiration to maybe make some adjustments so we can be in healthier community and some healthier spaces. We'll be right back.
Welcome back. We're going to spend a little bit of time reflecting on our 39th President, Jimmy Carter, who passed away on December 29th at the age of 100, whose life and legacy is complex, and his post-presidential life in many ways was more inspiring than his presidential life. Pastor Brian, you recently read his biography. What stands out to you about his life and legacy?
Yeah, he's an extraordinary individual, and I've referenced this on the show before, that probably the nerdiest of my nerdy hobbies is I read a presidential biography or memoir every year, and I purposely chose to read about Jimmy Carter because I knew he was approaching death, and he nearly made it out of the year. 22 months in hospice care, by the way, which is pretty extraordinary. I think certainly from a Christian standpoint, and I'm going to preface all of this with, none of this is about the man's politics, Democrat, Republican, whatever. Please listen to it through that lens. If you cannot help yourself, but hear this as some sort of left-right thing, maybe just skip to the next segment, because that's simply not what we're doing here. But Jimmy Carter was almost certainly the most devout Christian president in American history. Yeah. That his faith was an extraordinarily important part of his life, pre-presidency, during, and then afterwards. You made reference in your comments, Josh, that his post-presidency was amazing, that he was a very prolific author, but he didn't sign some huge book deal and go give six-figure speeches all over the place.
Lord, do it for me.
He moved back to a home in Plains, Georgia, whose value was less than the value of the Secret Service vehicles parked outside to protect him. He taught Sunday school. He was a successful peanut farmer. He became this sort of citizen diplomat who would go around the world protecting democracy and helping to ensure free and fair elections. And something that really was highlighted to me about Jimmy Carter is that, frankly, I think part of the reason why he was not a very successful president is he was simply too good of a person. Mm. He ran on the campaign promise that I will not lie to you. And whether he was able to keep that perfectly or not is a matter of debate, but certainly it was a significant part of who he was. He didn't really like the kind of the sweetheart deals and the you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours element that is so prevalent in politics, certainly before him and even after him, that he was a straight shooter who was honest. A speech that he was roundly criticized for. In fact, it became called the malaise speech that he gave in July 15th in 1979. It came after him responding to criticism by going to Camp David and inviting all sorts of different voices to say, hey, what's going wrong? What do you not like? What are you not seeing? And he was very honest with people. He was what he lacked in style, which hurt him tremendously, he made up for with substance and just being a genuine, honest human being. And I'll wrap up and I'll throw it to you, Pastor Judah, in just a second. But I think even you look at the contrast between one of the biggest problems in his presidency was the Iran hostage crisis. Yeah. And certainly he and his administration deserve a good portion of the blame that they got for that crisis. But I want to contrast the manner in which he dealt with the crisis, taking it extremely personally. It consumed him trying to get these individuals released. He made mistakes, absolutely. Like I'm not going to try to sugarcoat that. He made tremendous mistakes, but he held back on campaigning for president because he was so focused on this. And you look at him who, his focus on freeing the hostages negatively impacted his ability to campaign, whereas there is very significant and strong evidence to suggest that his opponent's campaign was actually back-channeling with those who had kept these folks hostage, saying, hey, let's make sure they don't get out before the election. So I think, man, you look at Washington today, you're not going to find anyone with half the personal character of Jimmy Carter, regardless of politics. And those are just some of the things I really respect about him. Pastor Judah, how about you?
Yeah, what I think is so interesting about Jimmy Carter is that he really was like a good dude, right? Yeah. And when we say a good dude, we're not trying to venerate him or saint him, right?
Sure.
He was complicated. He had some complicated ideas.
Yes.
He had some of the same complexities and challenges that powerful men have when they become powerful men.
Yep.
He, you know, really... one of the things that is said about him is that he was a micromanager.
Yep.
Just kind of always on his people about every detail, and that would slow things down.
Yep.
But he was a good dude, and at least people think. Of course, I don't know Jimmy Carter myself, but people really believe what he said he believed was what he believed.
Yeah.
That was a terrible way to say that, but and I think that. That is something that is so valuable and so not prevalent in a lot of political spaces today, yeah. Where you do, even if somebody says the thing that you believe, you don't really know, do you really believe that? Do they really believe that? And so I think that there's also all of these kind of parallels in terms of like what sort of things were problematic for his presidency and what other presidents have wrestled with.
Yeah.
What we know from his presidency is that if the economy is bad, if there's any sort of international conflict going on, if there's high inflation, that president probably is not going to get reelected. And so he lost his election. And I think what he models for us is what do we do then?
Yeah.
What do we do when the thing that you have invested in, you have worked in, gave your blood, sweat, and tears, and you have failed.
Yeah.
I put that in air quotes, but you have failed at that. How do you then recover and get back up and become helpful to the world again? And I think that it is beautiful seeing all of these people say, you know what, they have complex feelings about his presidency, but there's kind of an almost unanimous agreement that the work that he did, his humanitarian work, after his presidency, was so powerful and so effective, and that's just really encouraging to me as somebody who drops the ball.
And he had some real challenges as a leader, and even in all the positive things I said, I don't want to be totally rose-colored glasses. I think you brought it up, Pastor Judah. He was not an especially inspiring leader, and certainly there were some factors that were beyond his control. But he was a micromanager. He was not a visionary, and I think that affected him in a lot of ways. I love Kai Bird, one of his biographers. That's not the biography I read, but I love what Kai Bird said, that Jimmy Carter is the only person in history to use the presidency as a stepping stone to bigger things. And what a legacy. So Josh, I don't know, what are some of your thoughts of what we can learn from him or take away?
Yeah, the word legacy, I think, is huge. I think what Jimmy Carter did post-presidency, which is the only Jimmy Carter I know.
Right. None of us were alive.
I was born in 83. And so he was long gone from a presidential sphere. But his actions revealed that he actually believed what what he said he believed. Yeah. And while I don't agree with all of his theological points, if we want to rip those apart, like,
sure.
like saying that he's a good person and a good Christian doesn't mean I believe, like, we would agree
yeah.
on
sure.
everything.
Yeah, of course.
But at the same time, like, he legitimately wanted to care for people around the globe and to see developing nations get the healthcare
yeah.
that they deserve
yeah.
in really meaningful ways. He spent a lot of time into the peace talks, even outside of his presidency,
yeah.
Trying to see democracy go to nations that wanted
yeah.
it. Like he spent a lot of his time doing the things that he said he cared about.
Yeah.
And it really reflects a lot of his presidency. The things that I was reading on that I found really interesting is, and I don't know, because I don't know his intentions, how much he really knew that, but he was honest even when it cost him.
Yeah. yeah.
It cost him a lot to be very honest with people.
Yeah. yeah.
And he still was vulnerable and honest in that malaise speech. Like it was very self-reflective. It ultimately
wasn't exactly inspiring.
It wasn't inspiring because he didn't really turn the corner enough for people to
sure.
really say, okay, and now here's what we're going to do. But it was an example of like, sometimes our integrity is more important than our outcomes.
Oh, that's
good.
And he was willing to pay that price, and he yeah. ultimately did pay a price for integrity, but there's not a single person that has said anything about his integrity or challenged his integrity.
Yeah.
Even President Trump, who is not the most complimentary person to hit the political sphere.
Especially to his critics. And Carter has criticized him.
And especially to his critics. And
yeah.
Carter has criticized him. Still gave a very honoring
yeah.
and very, like, respectable a response to his passing, saying, hey, we didn't agree on how to run this. I'm paraphrasing, obviously. We didn't agree on how to run this country, but I know he loved this country, and I know he always did his best for this country.
Yeah.
Like, and that's a respect level that even
yeah.
Somebody who's not known for showing respect to others, to show to a critic of his, I thought that's just a testament of the legacy that Jimmy yeah. Carter actually has.
Yeah. And even to that point, he and Gerald Ford, who he defeated to become president, became great friends. At Ford's request, Jimmy spoke at his funeral. And wow. that just shows you, once again, I think that idea of want to be somebody who can be a person of integrity, who can get along with people, and I think just, maybe we can begin to kind of land the plane with this. So much of leadership is stewardship,
yeah.
right? Whether you're leading your family, leading in church, leading in business, leading in the political sphere, whatever, it's stewardship. And too often, we are incentivized to leverage our leadership power for selfish ends.
Mm.
And too often, that selfishness is rewarded in ways that kind of reinforce negative behavior.
Yeah.
I look at Jimmy, who, again, complicated person. I'm not saying he's perfect in any regard.
But a good dude.
But as a human being, you want to look at someone who leveraged the post-presidency to make a difference in the world, who leveraged his extraordinary intelligence. I mean, he was a nuclear engineer. He was a carpenter. He was a peanut farmer. He did a lot of stuff. And how he put that to work for the benefit of others, I think, you know, wherever, again, this is nothing to do with his politics, wherever you are in the political sphere, that is inspiring. And that's one of the biggest things I take away from his life, is just sort of a personal challenge to me and for the rest of us.
I also think that it is just a reminder that the being the good person, having the good character, being integrous, that history remembers that, right? That is not forgotten, yep. even though I am sure if you could sit Jimmy down and say, Jimmy, tell me about what was going on. And he would tell you it was terrible. I was having such a hard time. I was so stressed, you know, that it probably did not feel good
yep.
to live out the character that he lived out in the moment. But that on the other side of it, like that history remembers, you know, the good people
yep.
that didn't have anything flashy or exciting. He was not particularly charismatic. He was not particularly exciting. He was not some, you know, huge star that shot out of a cannon and took over there. No, he was not, but he was good. And there's value there.
Yeah. And I think he ran the race to win the prize.
Yeah.
Like he followed after Paul's words.
Yeah.
Like he wasn't so distracted by what happened in life that he didn't continue to go. And I think for us as believers, as we go through life, not allowing our failures or perceived failures dictate how we live.
Yeah.
And to say we're still going to run, even when we hit obstacles, even when we hit failure, we're still going to run the race as if to win the prize. And the prize is really a life with Christ.
Yeah.
That the prize is eternity with Christ. The prize is seeing God's kingdom here on earth. You know, seeing his will be done. Like that is the prize. And when I look at Jimmy's post-presidential life, I see kingdom-mindedness all over the place.
Yeah.
Of he wants to see every nation come to not just a salvific mentality. He wants to see them experience freedom from ailments now.
Yeah.
He wants to, like, they can achieve peace. Like the peace in the Middle East became this whole joke of a thing by the end of everything. But he honestly believed in that, that peace was achievable. And he, because of that, he was able to leave a legacy that was inspiring. And for us as Christians, it's like, it doesn't matter what our bank accounts look like. It doesn't matter what our successes look like. What matters is what's our integrity?
Yeah.
How will people remember us? Will they remember us for being people that actually did what we said?
Yeah.
Will they remember us as people who really cared about God's kingdom?
Yeah.
You know, or will they remember that we cared about more about being right?
Yeah.
More than about being
popular, more about power, yeah, more
winning.
About, yeah.
You know, that whole thing. Like, life is not a competition.
Yep.
It really isn't. But we are in competition with ourselves.
Yep.
It's not one another. It's competition with ourselves of, will I do what is necessary in order to see God's kingdom come, his will be done on earth as it is in heaven.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely.
That's, well done, President
Carter. Well said. So, yeah, well done to him. One of only, 45 individuals to hold the office of president. Flags are going to be at half-mast for the next bit in honor of his life. Longest living president, by far longest post-presidency of anybody, and just a Christian man.
See, because when you're nice to people, you live longer.
You live longer. May that be true. We'll be right back. The time of year, of course, where we'll do a lot of you'll see a lot of retrospectives on the year that was and predictions for the year ahead. Some
Tap
of those
into your prophetic
predictions are serious, some of them are silly, and we are here today with three of our predictions for 2025, what we think you can expect to see in the year ahead. We are aiming for not super serious, but not totally, well, I don't know. We'll see. Maybe they will be totally ridiculous. We haven't shared them with each other. So, Josh, let's start with you. 2025 will be the year that what?
Travis Kelce gets engaged with Taylor Swift, but she calls off the wedding before the year is out for her most anticipated album release yet.
This man just cursed this lady's marriage.
Oh my goodness. I feel like that would tear a hole. The teenage and preteen angst that would cause.
Do you know how high the depression rate is going to go with teenagers 12
to
17?
Do you know how good that album will be?
So you're saying.
That's true.
Okay. She calls off. So she calls off. Mine is so lame compared to this. She calls off the wedding and then releases an album like about the breakup because that's what she writes about.
Marketing. That would be the wedding of the century, though.
That would be the wedding of the century.
That would be
see you
the
later.
Breakup of the century.
Breakup of the century.
If they're engaged.
Album of the century.
I'm just, hey.
All right.
If this really happens, Josh.
Oh, I got to write her an apology letter and just send it in and be like, I don't know. Maybe who or do I go need, into marketing.
Who do you need to apologize to in this instance? I don't think it's her. I think it's him. I mean, she's going to be fine. She's got her new album. And
look, probably I like a long list of suitors.
I like Taylor Swift's music, I'll be honest.
Sure.
But she seems like a long day. And so this might be saving him a life of turmoil and pain.
Now, Swifties, his email is
J-U-H-T.
I'm telling you, the Swifties going to come for your throat. How dare you disrespect our hyper-capitalist queen?
One of the three of us just said that, and the views of each host do not reflect the views of the other.
This is also my last week on the podcast.
Okay, Josh, this was a nice experiment.
We're glad that you were able to come in today. Don't call us. We'll call you.
Judah, 2025 will be the year that...
That smart toilets become a thing everywhere.
Oh my gosh.
I mean, what is a smart toilet? I think that we're going to have toilets that have screens attached.
Why?
Because I think that everything else is getting smart.
What is a screen on my toilet telling me?
I don't know. But I think that there's going to be like food compartments on like the bottom of the toilet.
Hold on.
I think they're going to have trays.
No.
I think chargers, charging stations.
You know what else is dated?
I think you will be able to not leave your house.
Look, you know what else
is
dated?
I don't leave my house to use the bathroom anyway, but go on.
You know what else is dated? The fork. And the fork has been with us for a long time because it is the exact tool that we need. We don't need a toilet to talk to us.
I think the toilets are going to have speakers.
Why?
I think there'll
be different settings. How long are you spending on the toilet?
I think that
Do you not have AirPods?
Yeah.
You can do this on your own.
You're describing a smartphone, Judah, which
I think a smart toilet is brilliant. I think it would be nice if the toilets can move.
You can sit
on the toilet and then not even have to stay in the bathroom. Like, it has wheels. You can move.
Why?
Because you left your phone in the living room.
No,
or your books on the shelf.
Look,
or
I don't need the bidet.
You'll be grateful
that kind of
moment
info.
When you run out of toilet paper and you don't have to say, hey, somebody, can you bring me a toilet paper? You'll just press a button. The toilet will roll you to the linen cabinet.
I will tell you one thing that would entertain me, though, is if the bidet can run the World of Color fountain show that Disney does.
At Disney?
And it can give a miniature version of that in my home.
I'm going to add one more really quickly.
Okay.
I think 2025 will be the year that we finally decide to outsource all of the dating that happens on dating apps to AI, so that you will have a bot, and my bot will interact with your bot, and the bots will decide if we're an actual good match.
I hate every ounce of that.
Glad to be helpful.
Wow.
I do what I can.
Yeah.
I've always been a little prophetic.
I'm still stuck on the toilet. Like, I love my family.
I think it's wonderful.
The last thing I want is I'm like relaxing in my living room and one of my children is rolling through on the toilet. Buddy, just ask. I will bring you the toilet paper. Like, no.
I think it's fantastic.
You won't need toilet paper because the bidet is the greatest thing to ever be given to
anyone. It really is.
That's a good point. Yeah.
I don't know why it's not a bigger thing in America.
Yeah. No, I really don't.
So,
what's going on? Waste.
Huh.
All right, Pastor Brian, 2025 will be the year that...
Okay, 2025 will be the year that robo-taxis find their way to just about every major American city. The year of the driver was 2024 and every year prior. 2025, get ready. The robo-taxis are coming. We are going to be driving less and the robots will be driving us more. Praise the Lord.
You know, this is how they take over.
Have you not seen The Matrix?
Because now you get inside the vehicle and it no longer lets you out.
No. There's a video. I have not seen the video, but my students were telling me about. There's a video of a guy who was in like a self-driving car, and it was just circling the parking lot and it wouldn't let him out. And he was on the phone with the customer service people.
System error. And it wouldn't let him out.
Okay. I again have not seen the video, but
that's what I've been. There's also, you may be familiar.
Smart toilet.
Maybe you've seen Oh my God, that would help be helpful in that scenario.
See, you can bring your toilet to you
in the car.
That's to not, the robot. Not, see,
no, absolutely.
They call that an RV.
They call that an RV. That's right. Now, now you may be familiar. Maybe there's one or two videos of this online of human beings crashing cars. So the it would be a terrifying experience to have a robo car take over. But I am a huge advocate of human beings driving less of,
I am too.
I think I shared this as my best thing the week that it happened, that I drove in a Waymo, I rode in a Waymo in San Francisco. It was amazing. Driverless cars are getting better. There are some, I was reading about this, MIT actually cited it as one of their top 10 breakthrough technologies in 2025. They're all over the place in China. We have some initial roadblocks to getting them here.
Yeah, let's go ahead and be like China. There's our goal.
Hey, in this area, they are way ahead of us, and I just think a day when I can ride in the car, read a book, have a chat, watch a movie, whatever, and that I don't have to worry about me or somebody else making a mistake that ends my life, that'll be a good
day. Listen, to be clear, I am pro not having to drive myself, and I think people drive crazy. I think the fact that we let people drive is crazy in itself. All I'm saying is that the reason I don't think that that's a real prediction is because I don't think that the public wants that. I think you have to understand, we are Americans. We like control.
Amen.
We like to make our own decisions for good or for bad.
My pushback to that, I don't think you're wrong. My pushback to that will be, I think that where you're right is there will be a long period of adoption, that there will be a lot of folks who will be hesitant to adopt. So maybe we're pushing into 2026, 2027 here. But I think the more people experience it, the more they're going to get on board with it. And even think about this, to not have to own a car. Just, you want to go somewhere and just an automatic car, you don't need to own one. Like, there could be like a handful that are on your seat. I don't know. There are lots of potential.
No, because the way Uber's prices be charging out, that's going to be a barrier.
Fair enough. Maybe you do own your car, but it just takes you places. Self-driving cars, get excited. Well,
get more excited about the toilets.
No, do not get excited about the toilet. And I don't know what to think about this Taylor Swift prediction. This could be.
That was a curse. That wasn't a prediction.
I mean, this could really be something. At any rate, we'll see if any of our crazy predictions come through. We appreciate you joining us and would love for you to be back next week for another episode of Engaging Culture.
Bye.